Okay, right, so we're looking at Parshat Baha Lotecha, and we're going to be looking at a maimer, the discourse, which was said in 1974, and it was a Wednesday, the 15th of Sivan, 1974, Baha Lotecha. Now, the special thing about the 15th of Sivan, do you know? 15th of Sivan, yeah.
It's the middle of the month.
It's the middle of the month?
Well,
yes.
Well, 15th, I mean... No, I don't know.
Okay, it's a special date in that it was the day the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, was arrested in 1927. He was released on the 12th of Tammuz, which is a much more famous date. But he was arrested because he was spreading Judaism in Russia. In fact, he, when the Bolsheviks first came to power, when there was the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, 1917. So at the beginning, it looked as if everything would be good for the Jews. The Bolsheviks said anti-Semitism is decadent and it's a thing of the past. But built in to Marxism was a strong anti-religious concept. And the people who took that most seriously were the Jewish communists. So there was a Jewish section of the Communist Party called the Yesfektia. And the people in the Jewish section of the Communist Party, they were very, very concerned to eradicate religion from the Jews. And although it was permitted to observe religion, what wasn't permitted to teach was to teach it to children. Like that it should continue in any way. They said, yeah, we're not going to forbid anything. You know, it can all go on as long as it's just the old people who are going to die out. And then we'll have the new generation of communists who will have, straight communist, atheistic, materialist view of life. And the previous Rebbe, so when this transformation began taking place, it was already... it was like 1918, 1919, it was like a little bit after the revolution. And then Chabad Lubavitch realized what was happening, and and when the previous Rebbe became Rebbe in 1920, his father-in-law passed away, he got together his Hasidim. He said, I want 10 people to step forward, that they're going to be ready to give their lives, that Judaism should continue in Russia. And actually, Bensi Shemtov, who founded Chabad in England, Lubavitch in England, he was the first to step forward. The Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak mentions in the letter, he says, as you might imagine, to whoever he's writing, I can't remember who, Bensi Shemtov was the first to step forward.
To go somewhere in Russia?
Well, so what they did is they took a map of Russia and they divided it up into 10, and each person took responsibility for one area. And an amazing challenge. And Bensi Shemtov, I actually often heard him tell stories about this. He had 70 chadarim under his... that he was organizing.
Hi, Tali.
Hi, Shalom Aleichem.
How are you?
Wow. How are you?
Good to see you.
Brown as a berry.
How are you? You well?
Thank God, fine. Yeah. Yeah, that's lovely seeing you.
Thank you. You too.
Michael,
Simcha.
How you doing,
Michael?
Simcha.
Hi, Simcha. My name is Simcha.
Yes, so this this discourse was said on the day, the 15th of Sivan, Shabbat Ba'alotecha, like this week's Sedra. But that year it was said on it wasn't said on the Shabbat, it was said on a Wednesday, which was the 15th of Sivan. Today is the 12th of Sivan, coming to the 13th, so the 15th will be... Friday will be the 15th of Sivan. But that's the day the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, was who became Rebbe in 1920, and he passed away in 1950. He was arrested on the 15th of Sivan for his work in spreading Judaism in communist Russia. So he was arrested in 1927. So I'm just describing how he took 10 Hasidim and they took a map of Russia and they divided it up into 10 sections, and each Hasid took one of those sections and said he's going to work to, you know, with total dedication to try to see that Judaism should survive in Russia. A very interesting academic, Professor David Fishman, wrote a interesting article about this, academic article called Preserving Tradition in the Land of Revolution. And Fishman researched this area very well, you know, all kinds of different records about it. A lot of the previous Rebbe's activities were supported by the Joint. The Joint was a international fund trying to help Jews and Judaism, and Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak managed to get, I think it was run from New York, he managed to get the Joint to fund a lot of his activities. And so he had secret chadorim and secret mikvaot and all kinds of different things happening. So Rabbi Benzion Shem Tov, who was one of these 10 Hasidim whom I knew personally, I had that sought to know him. He founded Chabad in England as well. And it's his daughter and son-in-law who presently run Chabad here, Rabbi Sudak and Pradel Sudak. So Benzion Shem Tov is a very dramatic figure, and like a sort of a small dynamo kind of person, and full of energy. And he would describe, like on the Shabbat afternoon, he would describe how, you know, he ran these 70 secret chadorim, and, you know, different things that happen and all kinds of adventures, you know, and then there's stories that he wouldn't tell about himself, but other people tell about himself. He was a totally brave figure. I mean, just as an example, you know, from the chassid of a Rebbe, you see something about the quality of that Rebbe. So Benzion Shem Tov was walking along with another guy in Moscow or somewhere, and Benzion Shem Tov had papers which were kosher, but the other guy did not have papers which were kosher. He'd run away from somewhere, whatever it was. The Hasidim were always trying to move because they were there was a problem about work, because they wanted you to work on Shabbos, and there was a problem about children being sent to school. They wanted the children, to indoctrinate the children, make them into communists. So for whatever reason, his friend who was with him did not have good papers, and if a policeman would look at those papers, he'd get arrested. Anyway, suddenly a policeman comes up to them and says, "Hey, where are your papers?" So he says to the other guy, not to Benzion Shem Tov, to the other guy. So Benzion Shem Tov throws his arms round the policeman. He was like a short, tough, very tough man. Throws his arms round him. "Ivan, Ivan, it's so wonderful to see you. I haven't seen you for so long. We had such a great time on the Black Sea 2 summers ago. It was so wonderful." And the policeman, you know, he's also not a weakling, you know. He's trying to, "I've never seen you before in my life," he's saying. "Well, what are you talking about, the Black Sea? I've never been to the Black," you know. "Oh, you know what? You're not Ivan at all. You look just like my friend Ivan." Anyway, meanwhile, the other guy, of course, has run away. So the policeman turns on Benzion Shem Tov and says, "So where are your papers?" So he takes out his papers. They're kosher. You know, there's nothing that the guy can do, you know. So that's a story, not that he would tell about himself, but other people told about him. You know, so that's the...
He did it to help out other people, to help out his friends.
Well, he, yeah, by throwing his arms around the policeman, the other guy was able to run away.
Wow.
And be saved, you know, because otherwise...
What if he actually did not throw his arms around the person, the policeman?
Well, the policeman would have looked at the other guy's papers, and they were not kosher, and he would have been taken off to prison, could have been put in prison for years, you know. You never know.
Right.
You know, that's what was... Benzion Shem Tov himself was put in prison later. You know, that's... So the Rebbe once had a thing in Verbrengen, a Hasidic gathering in 770, a kind of an auction. Who has been longest in prison? You know, from Russia. It was all the Hasidim from Russia, you know. So one guy had been in prison 3 years, you know, then another guy 5 years, another one 7 years, you know, someone 20 years. You know, so the one, like, the Rebbe gave a bottle of vodka to the one who'd been longest in prison, you know. It was you know, they all got out, thank God. You know, those, I mean, unfortunately there were Hasidim who died in prison as well. Elchanan Dov Morozov. He was a great chassid. I knew some of his relatives, but he was a great chassid, and he was killed in prison. He was, you know, he was one of that group of people trying to keep Judaism alive, and he died there.
Did you ever read that?
Sorry,
the group of ten.
I think he was one of the group of ten. Yeah.
Did you ever read that Sharansky book? Fear No Evil, I think it was called. But his time, about his whole process of becoming a Zionist and then going into prison. He's a prisoner of Zion.
Oh, interesting. No, I haven't read that.
Firstly, they kept putting him in solitary confinement because he refused to play by their rules. Mm. They kept putting him, you know, all the time. So he used to play these games to just keep himself sane. He used to play chess games in his head.
Wow.
To work out all the moves. Yes. And then there was another prisoner that they used to tap things, and they worked out a whole system of talking to each other. But there's a wonderful thing of the Sharansky book is when he was finally released, they released some spies. I think the United States released some spies. And there's this bridge, and they got the spies here, and they got Sharansky here. And they eventually, the Americans had to release the spies, so the spies start to walk towards the middle of the bridge. And the Russians say to Sharansky, now what we want you to do is we want you to walk in a straight line and right up to the other side. So Sharansky starts to walk, and he starts to walk in a zigzag. And the Americans say, what's he doing? You know, what's he? And he tells them afterwards, he told me to walk in a straight line. So I walked in a zigzag. Because everything they told him to do, he refused to do from the very beginning. Because he said, then you play their game.
Right.
And he refused to play their game.
Very nice.
He just walked all the way along the bridge, walked like this all the way along the bridge.
Yeah, there's a similar sort of story about Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. Mm-hmm. When he was arrested, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, when he was arrested. So he also refused to play ball with them. Mm. So they said to him, how old are you? So I can't remember the number he said, but it was something like 320. You know, now 320 is actually the number of years of all the five Lubavitcher Rebbeim before him added up together plus his age.
Right,
you know,
so it was a kind of a true answer.
You know, and he refused. They said he can have a quarter of an hour relaxation in the open air every day, and he refused to have it. He said he didn't want them to have anything over him that they could think that they could think they could take away and bother him. You know. You know. So that's so that kind of thing. Anyway, the 15th of Sivan he was arrested. The 12th of Tammuz he was released. So the 12th of Tammuz is a big Lubavitcher festivity with L'chaim and so on. And for that matter, so it's the 15th of Sivan as well, since you see the negativity of going into prison is a step towards the positive dimension of getting out of prison, and in fact of transforming the whole world. So that's the kind of idea that we're going to have in this text. So just to take the very beginning, the verse which this is focused on, just the very beginning, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe Lemor, God said to Moshe speaking, Daber el Aaron ve'amata elov, speak to Aaron and tell him, Ba'alotcha et hanerot, when you light the lamps. But the word lighting is raise the lamps, literally, laha'alot. You see that in verse 2?
To elevate?
Yeah, to elevate.
What are you supposed to do these lights?
Ba'alotcha.
Elevate them to who? Elevate them to what?
Well, okay, that's all going to have a kind of a spiritual explanation. Well, what Rashi says is when you light the flame, you should make sure that you keep the flame by the wick so that the new flame burns up brightly, like the flame rises up. That's the force of the word, b'ha'alotcha, when you lift up the flame. But that's going to be part of what the discourse is talking about. El mul panei ha-menorah, towards the face of the menorah, ya'iru shivat ha-nerot, the seven flames should shine. Now, what is the face of the menorah? One way of understanding the face of the menorah is that you have seven lights. Okay, we're going to take this like Rambam design of the menorah, where you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, and here's the base of the menorah. Yep. Now, the Panei HaMenorah is sometimes described as this middle light. That's the one which is the face of the menorah. Yeah, and then you have the other lights, the other flames as well, and they are somehow like as if they're pointed towards the middle light. The only problem is, if you've got, you know, it's really like six lights pointing towards the middle light. The middle light's there already, but that idea of
they call it the face, the middle light.
Yeah, that's right. That's like the central part of the menorah.
It's at the heart or something, but anyway, they call it the face.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit like Shabbat for the 3 days each side.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't know the 3 days afterwards. 3 days each side. You know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Yeah, meaning you can say
Shabbat Shalom
Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then Sunday, Monday, Tuesday are the reflected glory.
In theory, also you can say Havdalah up until Tuesday.
That's right. Yeah, so absolutely. Okay. Yeah, you can say Havdalah up until Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So it's still carrying.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So we've got, when you lift up or elevate or illuminate the lights, the seven lights should shine towards the face of the menorah. Now, it's in that way, that's going to be the, that's like the window which opens to reveal a spiritual teaching, which we're going to try to explore. Now, in order to get into this teaching, we usually begin with the melody of the discourse. Ayya ya yam ba ya yam bam bo ya yam ba da yam bam bo yam ba yam ba yam ba yum bam bo ha yam ba ya yam ba yum ba ho ya yam ba ya yam yum. Hi-ya-di-dam-ba, ya-ya-yum. Hi-ya-di-dam-ba, hi-ya-di-dam-ba, yo. Ya 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 ho ya 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 ya. Okay, so now we got the Hebrew text of the discourse of the Maimah. Bahalot Chatan, which is 1974, Tavshin Lamadalad. Bahalot Cha et Hanerot. If you want to take the actual discourse, then it's finished. Mm-hmm. It's on the back, just to confuse everyone. Very clever photocopy. Sometimes gets things wrong. Vahalotcha tenerot, when you light the lights, el mul pnei ha-menorah, facing towards the face of the menorah, ya'iru shivat ha-nerot, the seven lights should shine, and the previous Rebbe, who is his father-in-law as well, Baal HaMaisa VaGeula, who went through the imprisonment and being redeemed from that, in his discourse, which was said in 1940, see in the footnote it says, that he said a discourse beginning in this way, he comments, so that was many years later, because at the beginning, Omer Bahalotcha et ha-nerot, it says, light, or elevate, the lights, nerot stam, without giving a number. Ve'eno maskir mischparam, it doesn't mention how many there are. U'l'achalezen, after that, Omer Ya'iru shivat ha-nerot, it says, the seven lights should shine. So we got the idea of illumination without number, and we've got the idea of seven lights. Now, this is as if it's two different levels. There's a lower level where there's seven lights, And then there's a more exalted level where it's beyond number, it's beyond count, which maybe we'll get to. V'gam tzarich lahavin, we also have to understand another point. Ma shekatuv el mul pnei ha-menorah ya'iru shevet ha-nerot, the fact that it says the seven lights should shine to the face of the menorah, hare pnei ha-menorah hu ne'am tzai. Now, various commentaries say, as it says in footnote 4, that that's what Rashi says, that the face of the menorah, so-called, is the middle light. V'havile lomar, so it should have said, el mul pnei ha-menorah ya'iru sheshet ha-nerot, should have said six lights would shine towards this, which in fact various people have discussed, like commenting on Rashi and so on. Unukudat ha-biyur b'zeh, and the basic explanation of this, the ha-nerot, now we're coming to different dimensions of what these lights represent. The ha-nerot shalem ne'emah v'alotcha et ha-nerot, those lamps of which it says you should lift up the lights, illuminate the lights. V'ha-nerot shalem ne'emru ya'iru shivat ha-nerot, and the other lights, of which it says the seven lights should shine, heim shnein yanim, they're two different things. We're talking about two different aspects of the meaning of the menorah and the lights of the menorah. Ba'alotcha et ha-nerot, when it says lights, illuminate the lights, without giving any number, nerot stam, heim ha-neshamot, those are the souls of the Jewish people. Shenikru nerot, the souls of the Jewish people are called lamps. Kamoshe katuv, as it says in a famous verse, Ner Hashem nishmat Adam, the soul of a person is the lamp of God. The Kamoshe haner, just as the lamp, Tivo la'alot ha'mayla, the nature of fire is that it seeks to shine above. It rises. The flame rises. V'lidabek b'shorsho. It seeks to cleave to its root. V'yusod ha'esh ha'klali. It seeks to cleave to the element fire. Shetachat galgal ha'yareach, which is beneath the sphere of the moon. You see, the medieval scientists said that there's the sphere of the moon which goes around the world, and under the sphere of the moon is a sphere of fire. The flame which is on the lamp, it's seeking its source. It comes from the sphere of fire. You can't see the sphere of fire. This is a thing that Maimonides talks about in Moreh Nebuchim, Guide for the Perplexed. You can't actually see the sphere of fire. Otherwise, if you look up at the night sky, it would be radiant. It would be shining with fire. But you can't see it. Elemental fire is translucent. You can't see any flame. But it's still the source of the flame, which is here in this world. Now, it's interesting that Chassidus has taken this piece of medieval science, which has become, in a sense, part of Torah, through the way that it's discussed by Maimonides and others in Guide for the Perplexed and in other books. In fact, in Tanya, Chassidus talks a lot about this kind of concept. So, and it means that that kind of perspective on the world gives a certain kind of spiritual illumination and understanding, which at the moment, scientists today don't talk about the sphere of fire. But it could be that as science advances and it discovers more and more different aspects of existence, which is so full of fascinating concepts, that there will come to be some kind of concept of what the sphere of fire is as well. You know, so it's the point where Hasidic thought and natural science, you know, there's a kind of a continuum, you know, where one end of it it's Torah, the other end of it it's some kind of very materialistic science, and then there's points where they sort of join together. And in fact, there's always a dialogue. I was recently giving a series of lectures on this. There's always a kind of a dialogue taking place between Torah thought and scientific thought, and the way in which one assimilates the other in one way or the other. So here we have this these concepts over here. So the same way that the flame is searching for its source, Kein haneshama hi b'teva haratzo, the nature of the soul is that it longs, it's reaching upwards, la'alot l'mala, to rise above, li'ikalel b'mkor chutzva, to be absorbed in the source of where it comes from. So we've got the idea. If we can take like a patch of this diagram, so we have there the sphere of fire, and then we have the soul, which is at this sort of lower level, and that's the soul here I'm representing as the flame of a candle, and the flame is like reaching upward. So that's the so that's that level of the soul. Ela, but shebeneshamot debia, the souls of Briya Yitzira Asiya. Now we have four different levels of existence. We have the infinite, Ein Sof, and then we have Atzilut, and then we have these lower levels, Briya Yitzira Asiya, right? Creation, formation, and action. So we're talking first of all about the souls that come from this lower level. So the souls which come from that lower level, teva haratzot shebehem yubehelem, the quality of yearning for godliness, which is in the soul, is hidden. That's the soul is weaker. You see, when it says the soul is from a lower level, it means the soul is weaker. So the soul is inside the person. The person is involved with daily life, and the whole excitement of the person is that he recently got the latest kind of laptop or sports car or whatever it might be. You know, there are such exciting things to get in the world, or whatever each person can imagine in their mind what they think is. You know, you might get some, I don't know, 17th century violin at bargain price. That's right. You know, each person has their ta'avot for whatever it is. And that's what usually carries the person. You know, the soul, the idea of the soul yearning for God, it's something that maybe doesn't, we don't think about that much. It doesn't enter our consciousness. So, if for that level of soul, which is the three lower worlds, that aspect of the soul is hidden. Va'avodato shel Aaron, the service of Aaron, he lo'orer l'galot hetev ha'aretzo v'aliyah shelehem. The service of Aaron is to arouse the yearning, and the yearning to ascend, the yearning to connect with the divine, which is there. You see, the flame is seeking the sphere of fire. The soul is seeking God. And so it's the way in which the soul is seeking God that can be, for the soul which comes from this lower level, the search is hidden. It's concealed. It's interesting the way he puts it. It's not that it's not searching. It's that the search is concealed. And then comes along Aaron, which he means the inspiring figure, who illuminates that flame. And that's our role in life, all of us. We get illumination from one source, and then we give illumination to someone else. Each of us, you know, our duty in the world, if you like, is to discover that source, that Torah teaching, that spiritual dimension, which is going to give us illumination, and then we take that illumination and we share it with other people and we inspire them.
Isn't that what gets life going? That's what gets the atmosphere going. When you share one, when you be there for others, isn't that what makes it more exciting? And
I think you're 100% right.
Or not?
I think that's the most profound thing in the world, is the ability to get sipuk, the sense of meaning, out of giving to another person and helping another person, rather than a purely self-centered, narcissistic kind of pleasure. You know, so there are many ways, there are many varieties of gaining pleasure in this world. But the enjoyment of giving to others, you know, even food, for example. So, you know, there's beautiful food. You can really enjoy eating nice food. But more enjoyable than just having food is having guests who are eating your food. You know, and the pleasure of being able to, you know, lay out a beautiful table with nice food and guests are there eating. That's there's a positive sipuk nafshi. It's something very meaningful to the person. And so in everything. There's learning for oneself and teaching, communicating with others. And very often the process of communication and the other person gaining actually gives the person teaching a greater understanding than he would have or she would have ever had before communicating in that way. So that's the process that the Avodah, the service of Aaron, so to speak, you see Aaron in the Sedra is the one who's lighting the lamps. So that represents each individual Jew who is lighting the lamp of someone else, and there's sometimes special figures like Aaron, like the previous Rebbe or the Rebbe or other people who have this power of inspiration and are able to inspire on a wider level or a narrower level, whoever it might be. Now,
where are we?
We are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines up. Bahalotcha tanerot, the end of the line. 8 lines up, the end of the line. So, the Aaron has got the power to elevate the lights, and that means Bahalotcha tanerot, he illuminates the flames. Sheteva aliyah shebehem, the quality of elevation which is in them. See, here we understand the word Ha'alotcha, why it uses this word, going up, elevating. Because it's the soul which is seeking godliness. It's not just the idea of a flame burning. It's the idea of a soul longing for God and reaching upwards, and the idea that that should be revealed. Okay, now that's one dimension. That's the beginning. That's the idea of Aaron lighting the lamps. Now we have another thing. Vayeiru shivat ha-nerot, when it says the 7 lights should shine, what it says over here is quite interesting. This is not actually the menorah, as it were. That shining of the 7 lights, where we had the question, shouldn't it have said 6 lights? It's something different. That kai that refers to, it's an interesting word, kai. You don't have it in modern Ivrit. But it's a piece of Aramaic which has been assimilated into the language, the Loshon HaKodesh of the Kai really in Aramaic means stand, and it's an expression of denoting a relationship, like the equivalent of, you know, this refers to. So this is a point where we're balancing two languages, Hebrew and Aramaic. Which itself is an interesting thing, because Aramaic, of course, is a non-Jewish language. Hebrew is the sacred language of the Torah. And the fact that so much Jewish literature is written in Aramaic, the Talmud, the Zohar, that's Kaddish, you know, that's also a very interesting interface between different aspects of existence. So the shining of these 7 lights, that's talking about al hamaorot shebirakia hashamayim, the luminaries which are in the heavens. Now, this idea of shiva kochve lechet, this is another medieval scientific astronomical concept, that there are 7 luminaries which move. The 7 luminaries which move are the sun, the moon, and 5 stars. I think the 5 stars that they listed were Mars, one second, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, maybe Mercury.
These are stars. They're not stars.
I know, they're planets. They're planets.
Right.
Yeah, they're planets. But these are called the Kochvei Lechet. They're called the stars which move. So the sun and the moon, which are moving in the sky, and the planets, I think maybe Mercury is included as well. So it's Mercury and Venus, and then Mars, Jupiter and Saturn. Those five planets, plus the sun and the moon, make 7. Those are, see, Neptune and Pluto were only discovered later on. That's with more powerful telescopes. So those are the 7 stars, and that's what it means, the 7 lights. The seven lights relate to these seven luminaries in heaven, including the sun and the moon. And what is it saying here? Kedita Bamidrash, that's footnote 10, it tells us where in Bamidrash Rabba, Midrash Rabba, it says in the Midrash, Shahamishkan, here we are six lines up, Shahamishkan u'shakul keneged olam, the sanctuary, where we're talking about the menorah, the golden menorah in the sanctuary, the sanctuary actually is, it relates to the whole world, the whole universe. The kol ha'inyanim shehayu b'briyat ha'olam, everything that there was, that went into the creation of the world, hayu dugmatam b'mishkan, there was something equivalent in the sanctuary. V'ha'menorah shehayta b'mishkan, and the menorah which was in the mishkan, in the sanctuary, hidugmat, it corresponds to the verse, Yehim orot berakia hashemayim, let there be luminaries in the firmament of heaven, which was said at the beginning of creation. Now, when God said, let there be luminaries, it started off, there's only two luminaries, the sun and the moon. Umashe katuv, shivat hanerot, why does it say seven luminaries? Afshe b'mayma yehim orot, even though when God said, let there be luminaries, k'tiv, v'yaseh elokim et shnei ha'ma'orot, it's only two luminaries being made. Hu kishemesh v'yareachim ikerei ha'ma'orot. The basis of the luminaries in heaven are the sun and the moon. Aval b'pratiyot, but when you go into more detail, yeshman shiva ma'orot, there are seven of these moving luminaries. What are called kochvei lechem? What are called the stars which move, or the planets, the heavenly bodies which move around? So there are those seven luminaries. V'zeh b'ha'alotcha et ha'nerot, and that's what it means, that when you light the lights, when you illuminate the lights, ya'iru shivat ha'nerot, the seven heavenly luminaries will shine. Shal yedei avodato shel Aaron lahalot et ha'nerot, because through the effort of Aaron, who is trying to elevate these lights, to light the neshamot, of that they should have this yearning for godliness, through the fact that Aaron is doing this, al yedei zeh, through this, if we turn over the page, ya'iru shivat ha'nerot, the seven lights will shine, shenaseh tosvot or b'mayma yehim orot, it actually has an effect on the existence of the world, that the luminaries in heaven shine with greater intensity, al derech, in the same way that the Mishnah tells us that Sarah imenu, Abraham's wife Sarah, there was something about her spiritual quality that what she did, hosifa al hamorod, she added to the luminaries in heaven. Right, and footnote 14 gives a reference there to Midrash Rabbah, the idea that Sarah's spiritual service in some way added to the luminaries in heaven. So we have here this cosmic image that there's the whole cosmos, and there is Aaron trying to relate, trying to illuminate the flame which is in the other Jewish people around him, and he's trying to bring out those flames which really are longing for godliness, but the yearning is hidden. And by the fact of him doing that and bringing out that flame so that it reaches upwards, that has a cosmic effect and makes the luminaries of heaven and the whole spiritual structure of existence shine with a greater radiance. So there we have a way in which God has created everything, where there's some kind of interlink relationship between God, the Jewish people, the cosmos, and different things going on among the Jewish people, and the fact of people being able to inspire each other, having itself the power to make existence itself shine with a greater level of illumination. So that's why it says the seven lights through the Pnei HaMenorah, in a sense through the front, through the positive dimension of this menorah of the Jewish people and the souls, Given that, the seven luminaries, not the six lights of the menorah itself, but the seven luminaries above, they shine with a greater radiance. Okay.
So it's not suggesting that they weren't there before, because they were there before.
Yeah, they were there before.
So this enhances them.
It enhances them, yeah. Yeah, so there we have a picture of cosmic enhancement through the double service of the Jewish people. On the one hand, there's the Jew whose spiritual powers are concealed, and then there's someone else who comes along and illuminates them. So that interaction itself sets off a kind of resonance in the cosmos, making a greater spiritual input into the luminaries in heaven. That's so, I mean, just this image, just from this first chapter of this discourse, it's a very beautiful image. We'll make a lovely painting somehow. You know, you could imagine a kind of a mystic painting. How was your whole art exercise over there in Israel?
Do you remember that I once told you that in Sfat there's that guy, he's called David Friedman.
Right.
Who has a gallery with Kabbalah art, as he calls it. But it is actually quite interesting, isn't it? Because he does all the Kabbalistic, candles and all the connections between the two sides and everything.
Right.
You once looked at his website, didn't you?
Yes, that's right. It was very interesting.
He was a doctor, an American doctor.
Wow.
He got cancer at some point, which was cured, but then he just decided he needed to change the course of his life, and he wasn't doing what he really wanted to do.
Hmm.
And he went to Sfat, and he set up this, he paints.
Beautiful.
Then he said they do courses and things like that.
Right.
It's like an education centre, right, and an art centre. It's quite interesting.
Right.
I think it's called Kabbalah Art.
Well, I mean, I must say that this first chapter, I think, has got graphic possibilities, which you got the interaction between people and the flame in the heart of the person, and then you've got the cosmic dimension with the sun, moon and the planets. Alright,
so this increase in spiritual energy that's a result of what Aaron did presumably feeds back down to us
that's a very good point, because if there's an increase in spiritual energy in the cosmos, then everyone who's living in the world is getting some kind of benefit from that. So it's a continuous sets up cycles and
do you think that people who are not connected in any way to Kabbalah can see things that I was thinking just now, because you were talking about how graphic it is and connected to art, for example. I was thinking of Van Gogh, the thing with the stars and the moon, the very vibrant moon. Do you think that there are people who somehow can see things that other people can't see?
Well, I mean, there's two things here.
I don't mean just artistically, I meant it almost on a spiritual
level. In all aspects. See, there are two things. First of all, I think that every human being, everywhere, has got a certain spiritual potential to be aware of the radiance within existence, the divine radiance called Mamalik Olamim, the radiance which fills the worlds and which makes, whether it's the stars or if you're talking about Van Gogh, the cornfield, or it could be a wicker chair, but you can just see the suchness of that, the energy which is in that chair. That's, that very, very strong. So that's on one level. And that's anywhere in the world and any human being. The other thing is, talking about Europe and the European tradition, there are Kabbalistic aspects of the whole European tradition, which, certain aspects of the Enlightenment and of the forces that went into the Enlightenment, the idea that the world is being improved, you know, the even progress.
Yeah, yeah.
Progress is actually a Kabbalistic concept. Tikkun, you know, that there is a step-by-step process whereby everything is getting better and better till finally it comes to Mashiach. And it's all, you know, the way the Kabbalah describes it is that it's an incremental process, you know, so...
towards purity.
Yeah, so, you know, there are people who present, I've heard, you know, academic presentations of, you know, how the Kabbalah influenced the Enlightenment, you know, and the Kabbalah Leibniz, the Kabbalah this, that. It's all kinds of, you know, because you've got Christian Kabbalists, Pico de Mirandola in Italy, you know, whatever the purpose for which they were studying Kabbalistic thought and writing the Latin book, Kabbalah Denudata, you know, Kabbalah Revealed. But this became part of the cultural currents in Western European thought, you know, so... So in a way it would be difficult to be completely insulated from the Kabbalah, even if the person didn't think in Kabbalistic terminology. Mm. But on the other hand, I do believe that everyone, especially a inspired painter, musician, poet, you know, is able to respond to the divine which is there in existence. Yeah. You know, that response to the divine in existence could take dangerous form simply because of the intensity and the very tragic course of Van Gogh's own personal life is a case of not being able to balance that intensity. Or Edvard Munch's, you know, the cry, you know, is an expression of a person feeling that intensity but not being able to contain it, and it comes out in a very intense,
almost too close to the flame. Almost.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Okay, section Bet. By the way, this is a edited article. This discourse it was edited by the Rebbe, I think, in 1989. So it's 1989. It came out as Kuntres of the 15th of Sivan. Vehine mize shebe'alotcha et ha'nerot lefi pshuto ka'i ha'nerot ha'menorah. The fact that this idea of elevating the lights, which originally we said relates to the souls, but the verse in the literal sense is talking about the menorah, muvan, this helps us understand mize shebe'alotcha et ha'nerot bepnimiut ha'inyanim. The idea that lighting these lights inwardly means kai al neshamot refers to souls, ki haneirot neshamot hem hapnimiut v'neirot hamenorah. The lights of the souls, they are the inwardness of the lights of the menorah. So in other words, this is what the menorah really is. V'zeh shebemenorah hayu sheva neirot. The fact that in the menorah there were seven lights, it's because the lights of the souls divide in seven types. Val Pisa, he'll say a bit about that in the next paragraph. So, Val Pisa tzalich lavin tam hashinu b'lashon ha-katuv. Now, in that case, we have to understand why does it say shebenerot ha-me'orot that k'tiv ya'ilu shivat ha-nerot. On one level, when it's talking about the planets, it talks about the seven lights. Ubanerot and shamot k'tiv balotcha tanerot. But when it's talking just about the souls, it doesn't use the number seven. You see, there is a connection of the number seven to the souls, because the souls serve God in seven different ways. But nonetheless, when it talks about the souls, it just talks without number, when you lift up the lights. Whereas when it talks about the planets and the sun and the moon, then it uses the number seven. Now what it's going to come to is that there are two states of the soul. There's the lower dimension of the soul where there's number seven, and there's a higher dimension, higher kiva. There's a higher dimension which is beyond the number seven, and that is the higher dimension of the soul. Okay. We can understand this as it says in the Kutei Torah, Shivat ha-nerot ha-menorah, the seven lights of the menorah, Hem Shiva Sugei B'nei Yisrael B'Avodat Hashem are seven approaches among the Jewish people in serving God. Yesh, now I find this next couple of lines very interesting. Yesh Oved Ma'ava Mashuch Kamayim. One style of person serves with love which flows like water, and that is chesed, kindness. Now, what do we normally say is the second sphira? First sphira is chesed, kindness. What's the second sphira?
Gvura.
And what is gvura?
Strength.
Strength.
Withholding.
Withholding. How would we translate gvura in comparison with chesed? Chesed is kindness.
Severity.
And gvura is usually severity. It's interesting the way it puts it here, that chesed is love, and gvura is also love. The only thing is a different kind of love.
You know, like one's kindness and one's tough love, as they say.
That's right, yeah. V'yesh ma'ava kadish be'esh. And there is another kind of love, which is like flames of fire. So there's love like flowing water, which is beautiful and calm and peaceful. And then there's love like flames of fire. I'm not sure if that's covered by tough love, but it could be. I mean, you know, it's a very, very high energy of love, which is gvura. V'yeh, and so on. And so all the other five attributes. V'yesh lomam, one can suggest, d'zesh shiva sugi me'elu, the difference, the fact that these seven types of service of God, missing out the bracket, nikra shiva neirot, mean, are called the seven lights, miss the brackets, hu ki kiven sha'ani nivreti l'shamesh et koni, since the purpose of the Jew is that he or she is created to serve God, lachein, therefore, ha'chiluk ve'ofen avodatam, the difference in the service between these different types, nogel etzem mitziutam, is very significant for each of these different kinds of light, the way in which they serve God, whether it's this kind of love or that kind of love or the other qualities of the seven midot, that's very significant to them. However, what it explains somewhere else, b'makom acher, b'diyuk l'shon razal, explaining these words of the sages, Ani nivreti l'shamesh et koni, I was created to serve my Creator. D'zeh she'inyano shel adam, the fact that the purpose of an individual, meaning in the brackets, hanashama, the soul, hu l'shamesh et kono, is to serve God, hu b'nogeh l'briyato, that's the way the person's created. In other words, the way the soul comes down into this world. Yeridat ha-neshama le-briya, the way it comes down into the world of creation. So if we put over here the world of creation, you see, is here. Creation. So we've got the infinite beyond. We've got Atzilut. And then we've got, not very clear, the world of creation, and then formation, right? And then action. So these are these lower levels. Now, when the soul comes down into this lower level, and it's over here, for example, when the soul is over here, then we can talk about it serving God in this way, or serving God in that way. That's where we can see seven different styles of service of God. And that's aval, but. You see that word aval at the end of the line? Mm-hmm. That's like a pivotal word. Aval, but. Hanashama atzma, the soul itself, kamo shehi bevchina tohorahi, the way it is in the level of purity. You know, in Alakai Neshama, we say, Alakai Neshama Shnatata Bi Tohorahi, the soul that you give me is pure. That purity refers to the world of Atzilut. So when we're talking about the soul as it's at that level,
Atzilut again is...
Atzilut is the highest of the four worlds. We call it the world of emanation. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, at that level of emanation, So at that level, when the soul is there, it's in a realm of oneness beyond the seven. This is the oneness of the soul. So, because at that level we see that the soul is really just a part of God.
Is that prayer a Kabbalistic prayer? That
you know, from the Kabbalistic point of view, everything is Kabbalistic. That's a prayer, the kind of Shema. It's a very beautiful prayer. It's written in the Talmud. And in the Talmud it's presented as the first prayer that a person says waking up in the morning. We now have another prayer, Mode Ani Lefanecha, which isn't written in the Talmud as far as I know, but that has become over many years of tradition, because Mode Ani does not have the name of God in it. Whereas Elokai, it says the name of God, Elokai, Elokim. So we say Mode Ani before washing our hands. So that's like a level of prayer which, because it doesn't have the name of God, is even more profound.
I didn't know that. I always say it after washing my hands. I didn't know that.
Mode Ani is said before. Yes, yes. It's the first thing that a person says.
I know that.
And so then one washes their hands. And there's a great profundity about the idea that Mode Ani even precedes the washing of their hands. In other words, it's something so profound, it cannot be defiled.
Mm.
So there's a beautiful discourse about that concept of Mode Ani by the Rebbe that was translated by Professor Susan Handelman, a very wonderful piece of Hasidic teaching. Later on, someone else translated it as well, I think, or maybe edited her translation. But this was one of the first real translations of the Rebbe's Hasidic teachings. Came out many years ago. And it's a very, very beautiful teaching about the Mode Ani, and it takes Mode Ani in four different ways of explaining it: Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod. And at each level it explains the Hasidic turn, as it were, the Hasidic dimension of that explanation. So it's called On the Essence of Hasidism. That's the name of the book. It's a whole book, On the Essence of Hasidism. And a very, very profound, beautiful teaching. But it's revolving around the idea that the Mode Ani is something which is so high that it's beyond defilement. Which is very, very wonderful, wonderful book to read and to explore. So we have the idea that the soul, which is a part of God, Eino emtzayi le'eze inyan acher. When you're talking about the soul, which is a part of God, which is like very exalted, it's not a medium leading to something else. Its relationship with God is something absolute. We don't even talk about it as serving God. It's got a deep relationship with God. V'hatachlit hu ba ba'atzma. The goal is in itself. And so therefore, when you're talking on that level, which is this higher level, from that movement, it's understood sheitchalkut neshamot ba'ofen avodatam hirak b'daga da'ata barata. The distinction of the souls in these seven different styles of serving God is only on the lower level, v'lo be'etzem utam, not on the higher level. So therefore, when it says lifting up the lights, illuminating the lights, and it's talking without any number, and it's talking about souls, that is a hint that we're talking about illuminating the lights on the highest level, that we have reached this realm of emanation and beyond, which is beyond the division into seven. It's just at the point of oneness where the souls are simply the essence of the soul is really an expression of godliness. And that is without any number. Whereas when we talk about the revealing of the radiance in the soul, which otherwise wouldn't be revealed, so then we're talking about the soul as it is on a lower level, since at that point its yearning for God is hidden and it has to be revealed. And then you can talk about seven different styles of movement, so of service of God. But then they eventually come up to a higher level. They reach a higher level where they come higher and higher, as they were before they descended, even higher than they were before they descended into the world. All right, so here we have a whole process taking place within the souls, that you have on the one hand the souls which need to be awakened, and then through that process the souls come to a higher level beyond needing to be awakened, where they express their essential quality, and at that essential point they are unified with God in such a way that it's not a matter of serving God, it's just an expression of God and just being. You know, this is in a way like the seventh millennium.
It's being unified with God, in fact.
Yes, it's like the time of the revival of the dead. You know, in our time there are mitzvot, and it says when Mashiach comes there will also be mitzvot. But when we come ultimately to the time of the revival of the dead, the seventh millennium, you know, these real eschatological points, these points of the kates, the eschaton, the end. It's the end, it's really the beginning. It's the end of divine service as we know it, where there's a gap. Service means there's a gap between the individual and God, and the person is reaching towards God. But then there comes a certain point where they're actually embracing God. and that's the step beyond. Mm. Which is being described over here. The force of this discourse, I don't know that we'll get to the end of it, but the force of it is that it's the struggle of the soul in exile which actually releases, which triggers off these different dimensions going higher and higher and higher to a more and more spiritual point. That it's actually the descent of the soul, like here we're talking about the soul descending into this physical world. But in the case of an individual, especially like the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, his descent into being imprisoned. There he is trying to inspire people, he's trying to help people keep Judaism in a time of very great adversity from the communists, and particularly from the Jewish communists, the Svektia part of the Communist Party. And he is now put in prison. This is like a deeper galut, a deeper exile for his soul, but that enables his soul to come to a higher level, a more spiritual level, which then triggers off these different dimensions in existence as a whole. So it's a transformation, you know, so I could see a kind of a Photoshop structure, you know, of, you know, imprisonment and danger and, you know, all kinds of things like that, and then the illumination of the menorah and then going higher and higher beyond the seven lights to embracing, you know, maybe it's beyond pictorial representation, but it's there in the words of the discourse, this sort of powerful imagery, which then triggers off cosmic responses, which is the eschaton dimension of the cosmos as well, that the cosmos should change and become a direct expression of God, instead of, as it is at the moment, ha'olam, meaning he'elem, the world, the universe, is something concealing the divine, that the universe should be triggered off as something revealing the divine. So, in other words, that whole structure of deep exile and danger and threat is really triggering off a transformation in the whole of the universe. That's the direction that the discourse is going. You know, so just,
I once heard a musician talking about playing music, and he said he wanted to transcend his instrument, to actually just go into the music.
Mm.
So the instrument was no longer a barrier, in other words.
That's a lovely way of putting it. Yeah, you know? That's a very lovely way of putting it. Yeah.
Did he manage?
I think he died, actually.
I
okay.
I just feel like it is an amazing concept. Because the instrument was a barrier. He wanted actually to reach the note through.
Well, he died.
He died after that sometimes. I was just being facetious.
Well, I mean, the two sons of Aaron.
Exactly.
They yearned for something very exalted and did die. So it's interesting how this whole process has to be balanced in the right way. You know, and sometimes the way you reach that exalted spiritual level is by going down, not by going up.
Mm.
You know, so it's
there's the jazz musician John Coltrane had this quest to find God through playing music.
Did he say it? Did he say that?
Yes, he made a record called A Love Supreme, where he's, you know, dedicated to God, and he really, that's what his quest was, and he died very young because he played continually, and tried to become so pure, but somehow I'm not quite sure what happened to him, but I think he's almost disappeared down into himself, you know.
Well, that's a very interesting. I mean, it's unusual for people to express it in such a way that what they're looking for is God.
Mm.
I mean, the blues tradition would talk about God, but
quest.
But,
In fact, there's a book I read about. It's called Ascension.
Mm.
It's called The Quest of John Coltrane.
Interesting.
And that was exactly, you know, what he was trying to do.
Yeah,
he dedicated himself to that quest at some point in his life. And it's quite interesting because earlier on he was just a very good musician, and at some point he just took off, and they discuss in the book why such somebody who was seemingly just a very good musician suddenly became this super musician, and it's all related to this quest.
It's religious quest.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
And actually they formed a church in San Francisco called the Something of John Coltrane. It's quite interesting because they related it actually to the part of religion.
Right. Well, I mean, that's...
So what did he die of?
He died of cancer.
Mm.
But he died quite young. At a young age, in his early 40s or something, late 30s, early 40s.
Mm.
Yeah.
But, you know, you feel, I mean, he was apparently just practicing, playing all the time. Just practicing and trying to reach this sort of pureness.
Was he just an obsessive person?
Yeah. Well, that's the other way of looking at it. No, certainly a psychiatrist will say that. And, you know, that's true as well. I mean, that's also true. It's the flip side of the same thing in some ways. But he was just absolutely on this quest.
No, but you said he disappears into himself.
Well, what I meant was...
So that already made him... said to me something that it was more than...
Yes, probably. Probably.
Well, I mean, look, yearning for godliness and balancing that yearning with the world and is one of the crucial issues
in
life.
Which is what Aaron's sons didn't do.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
They almost became part of the fire, didn't they? Because that's the
end. Yeah, in fact, the fire. I mean, the way Rashi describes it, the fire came from the Holy of Holies and enter them and consume them.
Mm.
So in the one way, they got what they wanted.
In a sense, yes. You're right. Their soul joined with God, but they couldn't do so while remaining within a physical form.
Yeah. Mm.
And then you have the idea, what is the kavanah? What's the goal? You know, is the goal simply to join with God, or is it somehow to make this world a dwelling for God?
Mm.
Which is like a more global task.
Mm.
Than my soul joining with God. Mm. It's and that's
bring godliness down into the world in a form that's handable.
Yeah, well, and I think that's the image, the quite dramatic image that this discourse is painting, where existence as a whole is transformed as a result of the processes that this particular soul is going through. That's saying that it's really digging down into the difficulties of life and being part of those difficulties and trying to improve them. That is the kind of service which leads one soul to illuminate many other souls, and that soul itself then reaching a higher and higher level and helping the other souls to reach higher and higher levels until the cosmos as a whole is transformed. Okay, now let's take this further step, which is going to be with a further comment, which is in Perek Gimel of this chapter 3 of this discourse for Yuvan Zeh. Now, for Yuvan Zeh al pi Torah Tarava Magid. Now we'll understand this more through the teaching of the Magid of Mezrich. Ala pasuk ba'alotcha taneirot. He comments on the verse, this verse, when you lift up the neirot, when you elevate the lights. And he says, what does it mean, Neirot? Neirot heima mitzvah. The Neirot mean the commandments, the mitzvah. Kamo shekatuv ki ne'a mitzvah, as we have another verse. The light is a mitzvah. Ne'a mitzvah v'torah or. The lamp is a mitzvah and the Torah is light. It's a beautiful phrase. And so we had previously a verse. See, these verses are like hyperlinks. So we had before a verse, Ne'er Hashem Nishmat Adam, the lamp of God is the soul of man. So clicking into that, we've got the whole idea that we're talking about these lights and these lamps, and the lamps are souls. But now we've got another verse, which clicks somewhere else, leads us somewhere else, which is that the lamps are mitzvot. Now, so now we're going into the whole realm of mitzvot. Let's see how that...
The lights represent mitzvot.
Yes, yeah. So let's see how that adds into our general image. The kamosha ne'er shoreh bo'or, just as in the lamp, radiance dwells in it. Kacha mitzvah hapnimiyut shela, so with the mitzvah, the inwardness, the light which is in the mitzvah, hu ahava v'yira, is love and awe. That when the person carries out a mitzvah, it's not just doing the mitzvah, there's a real feeling of love and a real feeling of awe, which are described as the two wings of the mitzvah, so that the mitzvah somehow soars upwards. Now that's an old image, the idea of the mitzvah soaring upwards, like in Kabbalistic books, that the mitzvah has got wings. Two wings. One wing is love, the other wing is awe. So awe of the divine. So those two, and or love for the positive mitzvah, awe for the negative mitzvah. Or you could put it that in each mitzvah there is love that you want to do the mitzvah, and awe or fear that you don't want to not do the mitzvah. You're frightened not to do the mitzvah. It's something so beautiful that you don't want to miss it. So you're very excited to do it and very perturbed at the possibility of not doing it. So so there is a tension of love and awe together. You know, it's not just love and it's not just awe. It's the two together. And when it says that when you elevate the lights, so that means, ha, now this is an amazing thing. Et ha-nerot. Now let's just look at those Hebrew words.
Where are we exactly?
We're now the third line of the third chapter. The chapter that begins with the Gimel v'Yuvan.
Yeah.
And the third line, and in the middle of the third line, U'peirush b'ha'alotcha et ha-nerot. Now the word et has got two meanings in Hebrew. What are the two meanings?
The word et?
Mm-hmm.
For a noun, you say like et something.
Yes, so et is the sign of the direct object.
Yes.
That's one meaning, in that which is actually untranslatable in English.
Yes.
Right? And the other meaning which is translatable?
Pen or something?
Hmm?
Like infinite, from aleph to tav.
Okay, that's like an explanation of the word et, but just as a simple dictionary meaning.
Oh, it's a,
it?
I thought it was noun.
No, that's with an ayin.
Ka'et.
Ba'et. Yes. No, that's with an ayin. Yeah. Et.
From ot, perhaps?
I suppose it's a biblical Hebrew. Et. With.
Really?
With. Yes, you have... it's Ed has a dictionary meaning with. It's biblical Hebrew. I don't think in modern Hebrew.
You say tikach et shoshana.
Well, no, that's still the direct object, the sign of.
Yeah. That's right. It's before the.
So give us a quote.
I'm trying to think of a biblical quote. It's You see, here it's interpreting Bahalotcha et Hanerot. He's translating it, when you lift yourself up with the lights. Bahalotcha et hanerot. Just today I was looking something up in academic biblical dictionary, BDB, Brown Driver and Briggs. Someone phoned up, a writer, he wanted to know what is the root of the word Leviathan. So I wanted to make sure it had some kind of academic respectability, you know, so I looked it up. And said, but, Bahal.
What does academic respectability mean? Sorry, you know.
Sally's looked it up.
It means someone else said it. They printed it in the book.
Isn't there something with Noach?
What?
Noach. Something with Noach.
Noach. Yeah, I think you're right. Noach ve'et banav or something. Noach and with his sons. So
when he went, or maybe not.
All right.
Yeah, I can think of it, but in the other sense, when they're listing tribes or whatever, or listing a whole list, and then they say ve'et, but it's not.
Yeah, but it's
sense.
Always the direct.
Yeah, but it's not in that sense.
All right.
It's interesting that Ben Yehuda obviously didn't forgot about all that when he created the modern language.
No. Well, he kept the et.
Yes, but
Ben Gurion wanted to get rid of it.
Oh, really?
Ben Gurion wanted to modernize Hebrew and remove this et for the direct object.
Oh, really?
Which is, in fact, what Rabbinic Hebrew did. Rabbinic Hebrew got rid of it. But modern Ivrit preserved the biblical et.
Interesting.
It's an interesting link to the past.
Maybe that's why he wanted to keep it, because he felt it was necessary to have a link.
Why Ben Yehuda? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Could
possibly
be.
Possibly, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, although he wrote his dictionary, but he wrote articles as well, I think, in Hebrew. I'm not really sure, apart from the dictionary. Mm. He certainly worked hard to publicize the culture. All right, so when you lift yourself up with the lights, the perush et hu gam im, and it doesn't give a footnote here, that the word et can also mean im, with. Hu sh'ta'aleh et atzmachayim ha-mitzvot means you should lift yourself up with the mitzvot. V'haliyah hi al-mul p'nei ha-menorah, and that means you rise up towards the face of the menorah, la'apnimiyut, to the inwardness. As if, v'al derech ma shekatov, as it says, v'yidaber lekim et kol advarim ha'ele lemor, God spoke all these words saying, anochi Hashem elekecha, I am Hashem your God, shakavana d'chol ha-mitzvot, the meaning of all the mitzvot, all these things, hi lemor, is to say. God said all these saying. What's the purpose of all these? God said all these things saying. What's the purpose of all these things? In other words, all these mitzvot, not only the Ten Commandments, but all other commandments as well, is le'mor. Oh, 1 second.
I think it's that.
Well, no. I mean, that is vayoled et shem. He gave...
Italech im Hashem.
Oh, good. Yes, he's absolutely right. Fantastic, David. Thank you very, very much. Look at that. Ele toldot Noach. These are the generations of Noach. Noach is tzaddik. Noach was a righteous man. Tamim haya b'dor atov. He was pure in his generations. Et ha'elokim hitalech Noach. Noach walked with God. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much indeed. Excellent. Thank you very much. Great. Okay, so et means with.
Right, got it.
Your husband found it. Right. Okay, so now we have the idea. This itself is such a, you know, like these things, they link, you know, there are whole discourses about each idea which is being mentioned. No. So, Vayadabele Elohim et kol advarim ha'ele lemor. In fact, this was in the discourse that we learned 2 weeks ago before Shavuot. this idea that when it says Vayedaber Elokim et kol hadvarim ha'ela, God spoke all these words, that itself includes all the Torah, all the mitzvah, everything that will ever be taught in the Torah. And that is, all those mitzvot is le'mor, to say, shahadam yachshov, that a person should think and say to himself, anochi v'lo yielecha. That is what it's all about. Now, what is anochi? I am. And lo yielecha, you shouldn't have. Now, the simple way of understanding it, that's the first two commandments. I am Hashem, your God. V'lo yielecha, there shouldn't be for you any other gods, al panai, before me. Right? But here, it's making a roshei tevot. It's connecting together the initial letters. Hainu, that means aleph, vav, yud. Aleph, vav, yud, do you see that? Is roshei tevot, is the initial letters. Anochi, v'lo yieh. I am God, which is the first commandment. V'lo yieh, and there shouldn't be for you any other gods. You see that?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Are you on the right page? She and I at the top. Yeah. Yeah. You sure?
No. Okay.
Does it say she and I?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So now we're just three lines from the bottom of the paragraph.
Right.
Right? So we've got Anochi. Wait, let's take another page. Let's just understand this. This itself is a very beautiful concept. Anochi, I'm the Lord your God, which is basically all the positive mitzvot and love. Right? Because love is the inspiration for all the positive mitzvot. Now, v'lo yiyeh, and there should not be, that is all the negative mitzvot. There shouldn't be any idols, any other gods before me, al panai, and that is awe, okay, awe or fear. So, Aleph Vav Yud is the Rosh Tevot of this letter, that letter, and that letter, right? But that is also the beginning of Ahava v'Yirah, love and fear. Do you see that? So Aleph Vav Yud is Ahava v'Yirah, love and fear. And it's also Anochi v'lo yiyeh. I am God, the first commandment, and there shouldn't be for you any other gods, the second commandment. Right? So this sort of connects together, that there's love and fear. Al-Panai, there shouldn't be any gods, Al-Panai, before me. That means the Pnimiyut, the inwardness. And the Pnimiyut is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Pnimiyut is godliness in its very essence. And that's what it means, that the seven lights should shine to the Panei HaMenorah, to the face of the menorah. It means the seven lights should shine, which are the 7 days, Shivat Yimei HaBinyan, the 7 Sfirot, Ahava v'Yirah v'Tiferet, and so on. Love, fear, splendor, victory, submission, dedication, fulfillment, the 7 Sfirot, they are all shining towards the Panimiyut, towards the inwardness of everything, which is the Holy One, blessed be He. And so that means, taking it a little bit quicker now, I'm just going to go quickly through the basic idea. So this seems to mean that the inwardness of the mitzvot have got two concepts. One is that through keeping the mitzvot, which are in a sense the lamp, the vessel, one comes to love and fear, which and love and awe, which is the light. And that's what it means, I am the Lord your God, and you shouldn't have any other gods, which are in general all the positive mitzvot. see, this is the positive mitzvot, and the and you should not have is all the negative, right? The negative mitzvot. So is the second one. So that means that the inwardness is like the light of a lamp, that the light and the lamp are in some way, they relate to each other. That you have to have the lamp and you have to have the light in the lamp. And through them, through lighting the lamp, you actually draw down something which is even higher. Alpanai. Before me. Now, in a mysterious way, this discourse takes the words Alpanai, before me, which is the words you should not have any other gods before me, which in itself, in a sense, it's like in a negative situation, you know, someone serving an idol, like ignoring God. But here it's taking the Alpanai, this before me, into an expression of the ultimate inwardness of godliness. And so then we can understand what is happening through lifting up the lights with when you're talking about the souls, where it's talking about revealing the way in which the souls yearn for godliness and they rise up to a higher dimension, to that level of Atzilut, which is absolutely beyond that level of emanation, which is beyond anywhere that they were previously, going higher and higher. Now this is the first level of inwardness, and which is like the love and fear that comes from the mitzvot, and through that one goes to an even higher level, Alpanai, which is to the very essence of godliness. So in other words, this concept that he mapped out at the beginning, that he described at the beginning, is here being mapped out in terms of the mitzvot themselves, that with the mitzvot also there is the idea of keeping the mitzvot, through the mitzvot getting a love and a fear, and then rising even higher than that to the very essence. Now, it goes on with different images, but basically what it comes to is the idea that the mitzvot themselves, on one level, they are simply, you know, they're things that a person has to do. You have to give charity, have to put a mezuzah on the door, have to put on tefillin, have to wear tzitzit, have to light Shabbat candle. There's a certain point where the person is doing the mitzvah in order to get a sense of love and fear of God and thus come closer to God. But because of this kind of construct, that the soul really has some very deep embracing connection with God, the idea comes out through the last chapters of this discourse, that the soul gets so bonded with God through the mitzvah that it starts working the other way round, that he's connecting godliness to the mitzvah. In other words, the flow, instead of it being a flow upwards, reaching from the world towards God, it becomes a flow downward where God is flowing into the world. And that really reflects this image of God flowing into the physical world and into the sun, the moon, and the five planets. So there's like, through the fact that the soul is ascending to this very exalted level, it reaches the point where godliness is flowing into the cosmos.
Because it's like something's been opened, the doors have been opened.
Yes, yes. And it's pouring through. And the same with the mitzvot as well, that the mitzvot sees that suddenly, you know, very often the mitzvah might seem a kind of a lifeless thing almost to the person. You know, the person does the mitzvah but has to force himself, you know. It's or, you know, some mitzvot are very, you know, you can feel a sense to them. But and a meaning and a spiritual quality, but it's presenting the idea that through reaching upwards through the mitzvah, one then opens that door and the radiance flows down into the mitzvah and into the world and transforms the world into a totally positive realm. And that's really the whole process which we're in the middle of. And the fact of the previous Rebbe or anyone going through difficulties and facing the challenges of this world, whatever they might be, which in his case were forces, you know, anti-Jewish or forces of different kinds, forces trying to destroy the nature of the Jewish people, but it could be anything that a person has to confront, economic difficulties, God forbid health difficulties, whatever it is, that in the process of that struggle, in fact, a person is reaching towards God and the door is being opened, which brings blessing and healing and goodness in every way. So that is this rather remarkable discourse. And I thank you for sharing with me your insights, which helped me understand it more. I think that opening of the door is a very beautiful image. Yeah. We'll add that into the Photoshop.
You know the seven planets that are mentioned, stars, whatever. It seems to me that a notable exception is us, planet Earth, left out. And that could be like the eighth, which is the one above Nate, the natural. Seven, you know, it's like 7 days. And then Mashiach's time, the eighth, and everything's coming into us from the seven.
Yeah, well, in terms of looking at the seven planets, you know, everything is seen as revolving around the Earth. Even if a little bit unsteadily, you know, but you see the planets rise and set. So the planets move like the sun and the moon. The only thing is, the planets do not stay still, because one day they're in this part of the sky and the next day they're in a slightly different part of the sky, and through the year they are moving around the sky. But in the course of a night, in the course of one night, each planet rises and sets. In fact, all the stars, everything rises and sets. So the Earth is seen as the center. And spiritually, what that means is that the onus is on us. We are the ones which are the baton is in our hands. It's
because the Earth doesn't move, does it? The Earth just revolves. Revolves, but it doesn't move.
Well, it does move. I mean, if you're looking at it in purely astronomical terms, the Earth moves around the sun as well. It revolves and it moves around the sun. But if you're looking at it in these spiritual terms, the Earth is still, and everything else is going around the Earth. We are on the Earth, and our job is to transform everything else.
Wasn't yesterday something on the candle and thing? The elements of the candle.
I think you're right.
To do.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Wick, the oil, and the container, but it needs somebody to light it.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. The Rabbi, he was saying to someone, you have a good wick and a good oil, but you need someone to illuminate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just ask a question about Tehillat Metim?
Yeah,
it's actually not a concept that I really understand.
What?
It's not a concept that I really understand.
But what is it?
The revival of the dead.
Tehillat HaMetim.
Yeah. Is it literal as it sounds? In other words, I mean, the reason that you don't cremate and the reason, etc., etc., is that the bodies will rise.
Well, how exactly the bodies will rise in relation to the physical bodies that we know? One of the ideas is that there is a little bone in the base of the spine which is indestructible. So whatever the body goes through, that little bone is left, and from the basis of that bone, the entire body will reconstruct.
Really?
However, the image of what happens is a literal image of a revival of the dead. And the chapter 37 of Ezekiel, which describes a huge army of people which slowly came back to life, and the bones came back together too, and connected together with skeletons, and then sinews and muscle, and then flesh and hair.
I always took that as a revival of the Jewish army of Israel rather than...
Well, the pshat way of reading it as a chapter in Ezekiel is that he's talking about the revival of the Jewish people. However, the way that the Talmud takes it is as a literal thing that he saw.
Really?
Not as a metaphor, but as something that he sees. And it gives an example in the Talmud to revival of the dead. There are one or two other cases of revival of the dead in the Bible. For example, when they were burying Elisha, his corpse touched. They were burying someone else at the same time, and somehow the two corpses touched. And so the effect on the other corpse, who we don't actually know who it was, or maybe the Talmud does say, was that he woke up and was revived, you know. And then in the book of Daniel, when it's talking in terms of the coming of Mashiach, it talks about the revival of the dead, literally.
Why is it then that Jewish burials outside Israel are in coffins? Because in Israel, they're not in coffins, they're in...
The first reason is because of government law.
Yeah.
Yes, you have to bury the dead in a coffin in this country, yeah. And presumably in the rest of Europe. But in Israel, there's the older Jewish concept, because there's the idea that the quicker the body rots away, the quicker it goes to heaven. So
it's exactly calling the words the Torah, returning to earth.
Oh, that's so good. Nicole's showing me from 2 days ago. Yes, 2 days ago, the 10th of Sivan, today's the 12th of Sivan. 2 days ago is the thing about a lamp, where the Alter Rebbe was talking to someone about him being like a lamp, and it needs to kindle it, and you are like a lamp with good oil, good wick, and a good vessel, but you need that extra light.
Is this from Pirkei Avot, or where's this?
No, Ne'er Hashem Nishmal Adam is from... this book is Hayom Yom. Uh-huh. This is a book written by the Rebbe in 1943, which takes little sayings for each day. And then yesterday's, that Nicole is showing me...
It was actually David, I have to admit, it's not me.
Okay. From my father's talks, that means from the Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Rebbe, telling the sixth Rebbe, which is written down here. The service of serving God according to Hasidic teaching includes all kinds of levels. The level of corpse does not need much elaboration. In other words, the person's dead. But thank God there's also revival of the dead in spiritual service. A corpse is cold. Now, there's nothing as frigid as natural intellect, human intellect. When one's natural intelligence, which in itself is cold, comprehends a divine concept, and the emotions latent in the intellect become enthusiastic and are moved by the pleasure which is within this intellectualization, that's true revival of the dead. So that idea of reviving the dead in order to, but through getting the mind to relate to, absorb and understand and get excited over a Hasidic spiritual teaching.
So in other words, the mind follows the soul.
That's
the mind following the soul.
Yes.
The other way around.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But in terms of the belief, like Maimonides wrote 13 Principles of Faith, so the 13th principle is, the 12th is that the Messiah will come, and the 13th is that there'll be the revival of the dead. Now, when he originally wrote these, he wrote the 12, most of them he wrote like a couple of paragraphs. And the 13th he just said, and then there'll be the revival of the dead. You know, and so he was criticized. He didn't say enough about the revival of the dead. So he wrote a whole long letter all about the revival of the dead. You know, like that.
What happens with those Jews who are cremated, like, you know, non-religious Jews? What happens with them?
Well, let's...
Are they just like non...
Let's hope they will have revival of the dead as well. You know, so, I mean, if the bone lures, this bone is indestructible, so it'll survive it. I mean, what about the Jews who died in the Holocaust?
That's right.
You know, they will certainly have Tchiyat HaMetim, despite being destroyed in the incinerator. But nonetheless, they will have Tchiyat HaMetim.
Actually, I find it quite shocking that Jews are cremated. Not just in terms of religiously. For example, my uncle was, my mother's brother was put in his will, he wanted to be cremated. So he was cremated in Golders Green Cemetery. And I found it absolutely shocking. You know, he was 80-something.
Yes, but you've got the green movement. You've got to save space, and it's selfish to want to be buried. You're using up precious earth and all the rest of it.
But
But no, what I found shocking was that somebody who was of the generation of the Holocaust, never mind anything religious, wouldn't think about that. I just found it. I totally sympathise. We both thought exactly the same thing. Wow.
Especially since the technique of cremation as a way of disposing of bodies was invented by the Germans in the 1880s.
Was it
really?
Yeah, it was a German invention. It actually became very popular in England immediately, but it was a German German invention.
But the Indians always cremated bodies.
That's true, but the way of it could be that different peoples did it in all. I mean,
the Indians
do it with a big pile of wood, yes, and the wife jumps into the fire. Yes. God forbid. Yeah. But the
past the law in India stopping that.
Yeah, it's against the law in India. But the Germans devised the mechanism, the modern method of basically an incinerator. Mm. You know,
really, I didn't know.
Designed
that
for human beings. Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah. All right, Simon Batai should be only good things. Now, today's Hayom Yom, this is a very beautiful book. You can find it online.
Really?
If you Google Hayom Yom, you'll get it on Chabad.org.
Really?
So today's, which is the 12th of Sivan, my father wrote in a letter. See, it's always the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, who is the. It's his words that are written here. The anthology was compiled by the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel. So my father wrote in a letter means the 5th Rebbe wrote in a letter, Rabbi Shalom Dober, cherish criticism. For it will place you on the true heights.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, very beautiful. And many people study, you know, each day read a little bit of it. Yeah.